These are questions of yogis in the Canberra retreat. First question from Benny. Sayadaw, please tell us a little of the history of this particular technique. Who first developed it? Why was it so controversial? And the background of Mahasi Sayadaw. Christian's question. Please could you explain why a state like anger is not an emotion in Buddhist psychology? And what is the difference between an emotion, fear, sadness, and a state like anger and greed? Question of Bhikkhu Sumangala. Is it possible to sit too long in Vipassana meditation? From Sky. Venerable Sayadaw, when the noting is flowing easily and the consciousness is gone with no object to note, what is occurring then? Yesterday you said to note, knowing, knowing. Question from Ali. Dear Sayadaw, from where do thoughts come? Is mind a collective pool into which we dip for our selection? Malcolm, please explain the relationship between the five khandhas and the six sense fields. From Alfred, in last night's talk, you did not seem to mention the arising of the desire for deliverance. Could you please explain this in brief? Also, when referring to the fetters abandoned by the stream enterer, you did not mention attachments to rites and rituals. Could you please explain this in brief? From Susan Trice. Dear Venerable Sayadaw, in your Time's Up stories, you described people who have become enlightened as peaceful and happy, loving no one and indifferent. I have always believed that an enlightened one would be extremely compassionate. Therefore, I am puzzled as to how one could be indifferent and compassionate. The two states seem to be opposite to each other. Could you explain, please? Peter Roblevsky. I refer to the story you told about the man who left his wife and child to practice the Dhamma. After he became enlightened, he abandoned them and was unmoved by their suffering. His attitude seemed callous to me. Why did he not show compassion for them? Why did he not resume his responsibility for them? Particularly since he had completed the work. And why would he like to be a monk and dislike being a householder? I thought arahants were beyond likes and dislikes. From Viviana McClintock. At the moment of death, with the consciousness that has fallen and is arising again, has it got any idea or control over where or whom it will arise with or who it will arise in? I'm sure about that one. Ian Chambers. Dear Sayadaw, my interest is in the application and benefits of Vipassana meditation to daily life. What are the most important things to be mindful of in order to successfully apply Vipassana to daily life? And how can we know whether we are practicing skillfully or unskillfully without regular interviews with a teacher? Can we measure progress or skillfulness of practice ourselves? And the final question from Philip Ayers. Sankhe. Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw mentioned Sotapanna doubts. Can you explain these, please? Respectfully, Philip Ayres.
The first question, altogether 12 questions, but the Peter's question is not one, about 4 or 5 questions. Peter Robleski, I told you one minute I must ask only one question. You had here 4 or 5. Many. Sarah, please tell us a little of the history of this particular technique. Who first developed it? Why was it so controversial in the background of Mahasi Sarah? Yes. This particular technique, I think, refers to the rising and falling of the abdomen. Noting of the rising and falling of abdomen. Is it right? Yes. Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw, when he was at the age of 28, then he practiced the Vipassana meditation with a very famous meditation teacher, monk, who was known as an Arahan. When he practiced under his guidance, one of the disciples of that Sayadaw, he is called Jetavan Sayadaw. One of these Jetavan Sayadaw's disciples is a layman who at the time he was practicing this meditation, he was a monk. Later on, he disrobed. He starts to practice this noting of rise and fall of the abdomen. He was one of the many disciples practicing meditation under the guidance of Jetavan Sayadaw. Mahasi Sayadaw also practiced this meditation at that time under the guidance of Jetavan Sayadaw. Then this monk, the disciple of Jetavan Sayadaw, tried many methods, which is the most suitable one to make progress in concentration, let's say, insight. Then he finds the abdominal movement as the most effective ones, because he thought the abdominal movement is the characteristics of a wind element, vayu element, vayu dhatu. It has many aspects to experience. So he tried it. Then he thinks it's very much effective. And then he told the other meditators to try it. The other meditators will try it. So they found it very much most effective in attainment of in gaining concentration as well as insight. Then their teacher, the Venerable Jetavan Sayadaw, accepted it as the one of the techniques which is in accordance with the Mahasatipatthana Sutra, because in Mahasatipatthana Sutra, the 4 foundations of mindfulness, there is a chapter, contemplation of the 4 primary material elements, Pṛthvī dhatu, Āpo dhatu, Tejo dhatu, Vayo dhatu. there. Patvi dhatu, earth element, means hardness and softness. Avo dhatu has the characteristic of fluidity and cohesion. Tejo dhatu means the temperature or heat and cold. Vayo dhatu means Vayo dhatu has the characteristic of movement, motion, vibration, supporting. Then, when you are aware of the rising movement and falling movement, with a deep concentration, you are realizing the movement, just movement, without the form of the shape of the abdomen, sometimes without the shape of your body, bodily forming. So, gradually, you come to realize a series of movements which are arising in person way. This is in accordance with or in conformity with what the Mahasatipatthana Sutra describes as the contemplation of the four material elements. So, Jetavana Syaro, the Venerable Jetavana Syaro, accepted. Then the Mahasi Syaro also tried that method. Then he also found it very successful and effective. When he taught his disciple, he take this technique. Then why was it so controversial? This technique of meditation is not the much controversial in Burma, because in Burma, many of Burmese siyaros, Burmese monks, are learned in the scriptures, so they know this method, this technique is in conformity with the Mahasatipatthana Sutras, so they do not argue upon the truthfulness of this technique, but there are some outside Burma who doubt about it because they do not correctly know the scripture, all the scripture described as to the four material element, contemplation of the four material elements. They take only name, what is that? Abdomen. They think when we note, observe abdominal movement, rising movement and falling movement, they do not pay any attention to the movements, but they pay attention to the abdomen. But in Mahasatipatthana Sutra, there's no mention about the abdomen, they said. That's why they are arguing about this one, because they are not learned. Then, another one, Christian, please could you explain why a state like anger is not an emotion in Buddhist psychology, and what's the difference between the emotion fear, sadness, and the state like anger and greed? Yes. As you know, the Buddhist psychology classified both bodily and mental phenomena into five aggregates. The first aggregate is the aggregate of materiality, a material process phenomena. The second aggregate is the aggregate of a feeling or sensation. It doesn't say emotion. Aggregate of a feeling or sensation. Then the third aggregate is the aggregate of a perception. The fourth aggregate is the aggregate of mental formations. The fifth one is the aggregate of the consciousness. There, aggregate, the second one, aggregate of a feeling sensation, includes pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, and neutral feeling. except this feeling, the other all mental concomitants or mental associates are included. And the fourth one, aggregate of formations, including fear, yes, fear, anger, and so on. But sadness is a feeling, a sensation. So it's included in the second one, aggregate of a feeling or sensation. So when the Buddhist psychology classified into these five aggregates, the anger, such as anger and fear, is not included in the second one, the feeling aggregate of a feeling or sensation. It could not be included there, because when we, the Buddhist psychology describes the dependent origination. Dependent origination has 12 limbs, 12 links. If I explain you very briefly, the through ignorance is a conditioned sankhara, the action, bad action or good action. Through the actions, the consciousness of a rebirth arises. Then through the consciousness of a rebirth, there arises nama and rupa, mental process and physical process. Through mental process and physical process, there arises six sense organs. Salaya now we call it sense organs or sense field. Through these six sense organs, there arises a contact with sense objects. Through the contact, there arises a feeling or sensation. Here, this is the aggregate of a feeling or sensation. Through feeling or sensation, there arises attachment or craving. Through craving, there arises a clinging. Through clinging, there arises an action or deeds. Through action or deeds, there arises the consciousness of a rebirth. Then through the consciousness of the rebirth, there arises a rebirth. Through rebirth, there arises a decay, death, and so on. So here, the feeling or sensation arises depending on the contact. Then, through dependent on feeling or sensation, there arises a craving. If the anger, such as the anger, is included in the feeling, here one link is missed, because dependent on anger, there won't arise any craving or attachment. So that's why the anger is not included in the feeling, the aggregate of a feeling or sensation. It includes in the fourth one, the aggregate of formations. Yes. Then, Bhikkhu Sumangalo, the third one. Is it possible to sit too long in vipassana meditation? That's it. It's possible. In Burma, there are some vipassana meditators who sit 10 hours, 13 hours, 14 hours, 20, 24 hours, and 36 hours in a stretch in a session without changing position. It could be done, but it's not necessary. It's not necessary. If you can sit 2 hours time, it's enough for you to make progress and insight as well as concentration too. Then the sky, Venerable Sierra, when the noting is following easily and their consciousness is gone with no object to note, What is the occurring then? Yesterday you said to note knowing then. Yes. When the noting is flowing easily, and the consciousness is gone with no object to know. The consciousness is gone with no object to know is wrong. Because the consciousness has its object always. Unless there is an object, the consciousness doesn't arise. Only there is an object, the consciousness arises. So, if she say the consciousness is gone with no object to know, it is wrong. Yes. What's occurring them? Yesterday you said to not knowing. Yes. At that moment, the consciousness knows nothingness. So you have to note that consciousness which knows the nothingness, make him know as knowing. Because you know it, it means the nothingness. So you have to note that consciousness which knows nothingness, make him know knowing. Then, Ali, dear Sierra, from where do thoughts come? Is mind a collective pool into which we dip for your selections? Yes, consciousness comes nowhere because it's not materiality, no substance, it's not substantial. But it arises depending on its object. When there is an object, there arises the consciousness and knows it. Then, is mind a collective pool into which we dip for your selection? No, the mind is not a collective pool. The mind is the thing which you should observe it so that it doesn't make you, it doesn't make you suffer. It's not a collective pool. The Malcolm, please explain the relationship between the five khandhas and the six sense fields. Yes, now I have mentioned the five khandhas. Khanda means aggregate. The first one, as you know, aggregate of materiality or material process, physical process. The second one is aggregate of a feeling or sensation. The third one, aggregate of a perception. The fourth, aggregate of a formation, mental formations. The fifth, aggregate of a consciousness. When we classified physical process into five sense fields, then the eye is the first sense field. Is the eye mentality or physicality? Physicality. Then it can include an aggregate of a materiality. Then the second one, ear, is it the second sense field? Is it a mentality or physicality? Then it includes an aggregate of a materiality and the first aggregate. Then nose, tongue, and body, they are also physical process of physicality. Then they are included in what? And the aggregate of a materiality. Then the third one, mind. Mind is mentality or physicality. Then it included both in mental formations and consciousness. Because when we say mind, it's not pure consciousness. The consciousness arises together with its mental concomitants, such as contact, volition, attention, and so on. So the pure consciousness included and the aggregate of consciousness, the other mental concomitants are included in mental formations. Then Alfred, in last night's talk, you did not seem to mention the arising of the desire for deliverance. Could you please explain this in brief? Also, I told you you should ask one question only. No, also. Also, when referring to the fetters abandoned by the stream enterer, you did not mention attachment to rites and rituals. Could you please explain this in brief? Yes. In last night's talks, you did not seem to mention the arising of the desire for deliverance. Could I mention or not? Did I mention or not? I mentioned. He seems to be sleepy. He seems to be overpowered by sloth and torpor. I mentioned it. I did. Yes. Then, when referring to the fetters abandoned by the streamed enterer, you did not mention attachment to rites and rituals. Yes. The scripture said, Sotapattimagga, the first part knowledge, eliminates ditthi and vicikicca. Ditthi means a false view of a personality, individuality. Vicikicca means this skeptical doubt about triple gems. Only these two are mentioned in the scriptures. But commentary to scripture says, Sotapattimagga, the path knowledge, destroys Silabhata Paramasa too. That's what commentary said. Silabhata Paramasa here means the round view by which one holds that to perform rites and ritual, one can get rid of a samsara. One can get rid of a suffering. The strong view is called Silabhata Paramasa. Then again, if one holds that performing rites and rituals enable a person to get rid of a suffering, that view is called Silabhata Paramasa, round view. But mere attachment to rites and rituals is not Silabhata Paramasa. Mere attachment to rites and rituals. When a person holds that if he performs the rites and rituals to triple gems, then he has developed the very, very much meritorious deeds. Then he is attached to rites and rituals. His purpose is to develop meritorious deeds, to develop merits. He performs the rites and rituals. Such idea is not Silabhata Paramasa. You follow? So only those of only one who holds that performing rites and rituals enable him to get rid of the suffering, then that idea, that view is a wrong view, Silabhata Paramasa. Such a Silabhata Paramasa is exterminated by the first path knowledge, the commentary said, not scripture, but it's I think in accordance with the scriptures. Then Susan Price, Dear Venerable Sayaro, in your Times of Stories, you describe people who have become enlightened as peaceful and happy, loving no one and indifferent. I did not say about it. Here he says, you describe people who have become enlightened as peaceful and happy, loving no one. People who have become enlightened must be classified in four. The first is Sotapanna. The second, Sakadagami. The third, Anagami. The fourth, Arahant. Only Arahants who have completely destroyed all defilements, love no one. Here, love, English, in English, the word love is very difficult to define. In 1979, when I conducted a meditation retreat in IMS, Massachusetts, together with the Venerable Master Sayaro, and the questions and answers session, one of our meditators, about 30 years old lady, asked a question. Put to me, what is love? I don't know what kind of a love she refers to, because generally, as far as I know, generally, and the Christianity, if you say love, it has two things, I think. One is love of your neighbors, love for your neighbors. The other is love for your spouse. So I answer that question. I don't know love. What I know is loving kindness. If you want to know loving kindness, I can explain you and say that. So here, when a person has completely destroyed all defilements and became Arahant, he loves no one in the sense of attachment. He loves no one in the sense of attachment. But he loves everyone in the sense of loving kindness. You follow? So that's why we have to use the word loving kindness to differentiate, to make difference from love in the sense of attachment. Then I have, yes, I have always believed that an enlightened one would be extremely compassionate, right? Compassion and loving kindness is different. Compassion is the sensitivity to the suffering of the other people. Loving kindness is wishing welfare for all living beings. But if you have loving kindness, you have compassion. If you have compassion, you have loving kindness. Not love in the sense of attachment. In this retreat, about, I think, a week after our retreat started, one of the meditators requested me to talk about love and relationship. love and relationship. I asked her, what kind of a relationship do you want to hear, listen to? She said, sports. Sports. S-P, eh? Sports. Spouse. Sports. Eh? No, no, I mean the pronunciation. Spouse. Ah, oh, spouse. Ah, oh, yes, spouse. Yes. Spouse. Then I told her, I don't know that one. What I know is the relationship of the, between the intention and the physical process which follows it. Very amusing. Therefore, I'm puzzled as to how one could be indifferent and compassionate, and the two states seems to be opposite to each other. Could you explain, please? And that, you clear? You are clear? Huh? This is Susan. Hmm. Need I explain? Hmm? Hmm. Compassion is not indifferent. It's not indifferent. Compassion is, this, I told you, the sensitivity suffering of the other people. It's a very different from indifference. Hmm. Then, I refer to the story you told about the man who left his wife and child to practice the Dharma. He want to copy or imitate this passing. I think so, huh? He want to follow suit. After he became enlightened, he abandoned them and was unmoved by their suffering. His attitude seems colorless to me. Why did he not show compassion for them? Why did he not resume his responsibility for them? Particularly since he had completed the work. Why would he like to be a monk and dislike being a householder? I thought arhats were beyond likes and dislikes. Many questions, not only one. Many questions. Yes. Why did he not show compassion for them? When the monks did not open the eye and was not affected by the suffering of these people, that means that the monk has a lot of compassion for them, a great deal of compassion for them. If he opened his eye and picked up the child, the baby, and and embraced him, it, then the mother of the baby would think this monk still loves my child, my baby, and also me too. Then he will come again, maybe embrace the monk. Then the monk is an arahant. If he did that, he would have a great deal of suffering because of his good bad karma. Bad karma. So to avoid it, the monk has to be indifferent. The monk was compelled to be indifferent to the child and the lady. When the lady knew that the monk was indifferent to them, with her pride and conceit, she turns his back to the monks and walked away. Then she is happy. She suffered no longer. She had no longer suffering. Then, why did he not resume his responsibility for them? Because this questioner hasn't yet attained the arahantship. He thinks he has a responsibility for lady. But arahant, a monk, has no responsibility for anyone. The husband has responsibility for her family, his family. The monks are not neither husband nor a layman. He has no responsibility to take care of these things because he has no connection with the former wives or child. So he hasn't any responsibility yet. Then particularly since he had completed the work. Yes. Since he had completed the work, he has no responsibility for them. And why would he like to be a monk and dislike being a householder? I thought arahants were beyond likes and dislikes. Yes, he was also beyond likes and dislikes. He became a bhikkhu not because he likes to be a bhikkhu, but his life, the life of a bhikkhu, is suitable for his purity without being any defilement, without having any defilement. So he has to live as a bhikkhu, not because he likes it. Then he is also beyond likes and dislikes. So Peter also has to strive to be that monk who is beyond likes to dislike. Likes and dislikes. Then Vivianna, at the moment of death, with the consciousness that has fallen, is rising again. Has it got any idea or control about where and who it will rise with? She wants to know this question very much. Who it will rise with? Or who it will rise with? Yes. When the dead consciousness has disappeared, passed away, then another consciousness, in the process of in the same process, arises, and then that consciousness also passes away. That consciousness is called rebirth consciousness, because it's the first consciousness of another existence. It arises and passes away. It hasn't any idea or control over where or whom or with or who they will rise with. Because it rises and then it passes away. But then here, you may ask one question. Then, what is it? Because of being reborn a rich man, a poor man, what is the cause of being reborn as an animal, and what is the cause of being reborn in the hell? You know this one. You know this. I need not explain you. You know this. You know? Yes, what's that? Yes. Bad deed or good deed you have done in the past existence. It guides the consciousness to be reborn in the hell or in Brahma world or in the human world and so on. So the first consciousness has nothing to do with these things. Then here, dear Sierra, my interest is in the application and benefits of a Vipassana meditation to daily life. Very practical question. Yes. What are the most important things to be mindful of in order to successfully apply Vipassana to daily life? Yes, when you live your daily life at home, you have to apply this mindfulness to your daily life as much as possible, but not specifically and not detailed. You need not, while you are doing something at home in your daily life, you should apply this mindfulness generally. General mindfulness you should be applied to what you are doing, not specifically. Say, when you are stretching your arms to hold something, you need not slow down it. You do it normally and steadily, and then you should be aware of it generally, stretching. When you bend the arms to do something, then you need not slow down it. You do it normally, but you should be aware of it, bending and so on. But yeah, what are the most important things to be mindful of in order to successfully apply Vipassana to daily life? Yes. Mental states, emotional states. These mental processes are the most important things to be mindful of. Because it's the mind that makes the person, make a person do evil things or meritorious deeds. So if you are able to be mindful of the evil thoughts, bad thoughts, this thought can be overcome by being mindful of it. When that bad thought, evil thought has disappeared, you won't have the evil speech and evil deed. So these mental processes are the most important things to be mindful of to apply Vipassana to daily life. And how can we know whether we are practicing skillfully or unskillfully without regular interviews with the teacher? Can we measure progress or skillfulness of practice yesterday yourself? Yes, better to have interviews with the teacher, even though not regular. Occasionally, if you have an opportunity to have interviews with the teacher, it's better. But you are able to know whether you practice skillfully or unskillfully. When the measurement is the concentration. When your mind is concentrated to a certain extent in your daily practice, then you can say your practicing is skillful. But if you do not have a bit of a concentration, then you can say your practicing is unskillful. Can we measure progress or skillfulness of practice yourself? Can we measure progress or skillfulness of practice yourself or ourselves? Can we measure progress or skillfulness of practice yourself? Ourselves, yes. Yes. When you can measure your progress by experiencing something new. If you experience something new in your daily practice, you can say your meditation is progressing to a certain extent. If you do not experience anything new, then you can say your meditation is not progressing, but it's stalemate. Stagnation. Yes. So that's a measure. The new experience, whether you have a new experience or not, is the measurement you can do. Then this question. Whenever Mahasi Siyaro mentions Sotapanna doubts, can you explain this, please? Where did you listen to this, the mentioning of Mahasi Siyaro? No. Mahasi Siyaro doesn't mention like that. Maybe transcriber make mistakes. Mahasi Siyaro doesn't mention it. You should read the other book written by Mahasi Siyaro, that you will find it. Mahasi Siyaro doesn't mention it. Then finish. Very good. In time. So may all of you having experienced something in this meditation retreat judge this technique is beneficial for you, and just try your best to have more and more experience and attain the cessation of suffering. I am leaving tomorrow about 9 o'clock, but Upanyavaro, I think, have explained you about it. I am leaving for Melbourne and car, so at night I'm leaving here and taking lunch in Canberra, and I think I'll be able to leave from Canberra at 11 o'clock. Then let us meet next year, December. Mm-hmm.